Hi, everybody. Welcome back to episode 8 of Lab Talks. My name is Ben Putley. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Alchemy. And today it's my pleasure to be joined by Alessandro Tesanque. So I will hand over to you to introduce yourself, kind of your story in ad tech and media advertising.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm Italian, based in London since long time ago. Mm-hmm. I work at the intersection of media, advertising, and marketing.
Nice.
For almost two decades.
Yep.
I've been around. And I'm an independent consultant.
Cool.
Working mainly on media monetization. I have been seeing the industry from different points of view and perspectives.
Yeah.
I work in ad tech. I work in the hybrid ad tech, media, which was Yahoo, golden years.
Yeah.
Traditional media and News UK.
Oh, I used to work at News UK.
That's great.
Yeah. albeit in their influencer marketing company, The Fifth.
Yes.
So I used to work with Ollie Lewis.
Ollie Lewis, legendary.
Yep.
Ollie Lewis that did a fantastic job.
Yeah.
By thinking of it.
Yeah, totally.
And making it happen.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of them now.
It's a great inspiration.
Yeah, I agree. He was great.
And that was my experience in traditional media.
Mm-hmm.
I was head of audience and advertising systems for the whole of News UK. So
okay.
Times, Sunday Times.
Yeah.
Sun. Then I work in mobile.
Okay. Yeah.
Always in the digital and marketing side of it. I work in research.
Yep.
Bridging traditional research data sources into the marketing and advertising environment. And then I started consulting.
Cool.
So I like to say that I've seen the industry for all different angles. Points of view, and I'd like also to hope that I can see better the opportunities and the challenges.
Yeah,
or better with a holistic perspective.
So I'd be interested to hear from you, Alessandro, what you thought the biggest changes, and I suspect it might be around mobile. But yeah, like when you went from kind of Yahoo to News UK, like, what did you see that was different from what effectively was a platform versus a publisher, and what challenges did they have, and how did you go about trying to solve those?
Well, I think what was interesting historically is to see that as almost everything in our industry, a mobile, instead of being seen as a channel, was seen like an end goal.
Yeah.
So that has been the kind of evolution that we went through. I can see that now. Well, the year of mobile is not is not mentioned.
There's
anymore.
A few of them, right? I think we've
not
got through
absolutely.
Them all.
Yeah. Is not mentioned anymore, and has become an essential channel for content and audiences.
Do you think that there is a threat, should we say, to the efficacy of mobile with Apple removing device IDs, what was it, 18 months ago now? IDFAs, pardon me.
Well, I mean, it's not just Apple. Everybody is going down that path. I think that I'm being a bit controversial.
Okay, yeah.
At least the reaction of my contacts in the industry, because I keep saying I wish that media owners had protected their own audiences and their own assets and their own data and their own user experience the way Apple is doing now.
Yeah, okay.
You can see the perspective from these from different perspectives, but I think it's also very difficult in the industry. Whatever move you do, there is also an intended consequence.
Yeah.
But I don't think that making mandatory for people to, for example, to ask for explicit consent to share the data to third parties is a bad thing.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's challenging because I think, like, News UK is, I guess, a good example given your experience. But I think when the internet and then mobiles began to become very ubiquitous, you had large publishing houses like News UK that were still trying to print newspapers and still have to print newspapers today, because it would be, I mean, almost unthinkable for a business like that to stop printing the Times or the Sun, because it's just been an ever-present in what they do. But technologically, it's very difficult to sustain that, because you have a printing press. It's a huge facility up north somewhere. I forget exactly where it is. And that technology can't really be used for anything else. Then all of a sudden have to deal with a whole host of new technologies. And I think that's where a lot of platforms like Meta, like Google, and then other ad tech providers were like, don't worry about it, just carry on doing what you're doing and we'll take care of everything else. And I think that suited publishers at the time, but I think now with kind of print readership continuing to decline, they're now in a position where they're like, okay, well, we actually want our audiences back. I think News UK actually have a platform called Nucleus, which is their audience data, which seems to be working quite well for them. So it's obviously very important. And I think that was kind of born out of necessity of just maintaining business as usual for them. But now it's become quite difficult given, yeah, print readerships are kind of coming down quite a lot.
Sure. Although I must say I'm not against print.
Yeah, me neither.
I think we should reach our audiences. Mm-hmm. As a media owner, you should reach your audience wherever their audience is. So if the audience wants print, why not?
Yeah.
And an interesting part about the printing facilities is it in Hawkesbourne?
Yeah, that sounds about, yeah.
I went once and it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
We think of something that is old-fashioned and archaic. It was one of the best and most interesting experiences.
And it's huge, right?
It's enormous and almost completely automated.
Yeah.
So you see very few humans around, only if there is an issue.
Yeah.
But it's much more technological than what we we would.
I think so. And I think if you think about the kind of the reader of a newspaper, are probably much less distracted than you might be if you are a user of a mobile. So although there's not the attribution to prove that ads work in the same way that you have with digital, there's kind of the anecdotal obvious evidence that if you're reading a newspaper, you're not jumping to another publication, you're just reading the Times cover to cover more than likely, and the ads are more impactful, I think.
And I'm talking in general here, not about News UK, but as a user and as a subscriber of quite a few media brands across Europe. When you read sometimes on iPad or mobile, it's like having to deal with a Christmas tree with lights going on and off,
totally
video
agree.
Auto playing, sometimes the sound going off. Mm. Very bad user experience.
Yeah.
And that's, by the way, it's a huge issue for the category, for the industry, because media owners have, I like to say that they have two customers, the audience, the user, and the advertiser.
Yeah, totally.
But while they can survive just with the audience, without the audience, they cannot have advertisers.
Yeah, true.
So that's one thing. And one thing also about me, I digress a lot. So feel free to bring me back.
Likewise, you could be in trouble here.
Exactly. But what you were mentioning about back to News UK, I think they are doing Nucleus and a lot of other initiatives that they have brought forward in the last few years. They have moved back into being audience-centric. Yep. They have reduced the number of ads.
Yep.
They have brought an important focus on consent, on the communication of the value exchange with the user and the subscriber. So I think it's sometimes one thing that happens in the industry is that people say, oh, yes, but News UK has got a lot of resources.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, but the Financial Times with that type of content. All these things don't grow on trees.
Yeah, I agree.
Assets don't grow on trees. Mm-hmm. Audiences are not forced to come to you. And we have seen a lot of great legacy media brands falling down because they had the wrong strategy, as well as buzzy, energetic, new digital-only brands that lasted only a few years because with a lot of investment because they didn't have a good strategy either.
Yeah.
So it's easy to say, oh, yes, but... But the, you don't escape from the need of having a strong strategy and being audience-centric.
Because there's the that when you say kind of the digital-first people like Vice, which unfortunately recently have shut down kind of the content publishing part of their business. There's Mashable and BuzzFeed and those kind of brands. I think Quartz was a publication that was brilliant at the time. I think they had a really amazing user experience, which was just like a scroll of articles, which was quite nice. But yeah, I think you're right. There's something with the kind of brand equity that comes with a publication that's been around for a very long time. And I think that that's one of the reasons really why we wanted to or started Alchemy was, I think more often than not, the user is kind of the forgotten person in that value exchange. And there was tons of ads everywhere online. And I think that publishers knew that was annoying users, but didn't really have a choice because yields were diminishing. They were losing viewership to platforms like Meta, where they weren't necessarily getting fair value for the news articles that were accessed on that platform. Like the Facebook audience network was great for Facebook because they could be able to deliver the last click attribution, which is quite important for advertisers, but ultimately they're not delivering the revenue that was due for publishers that spent the money researching, writing, creating, designing the content that ultimately populated platforms like Meta. And I think that probably losing a little to gain a lot more back seems counterintuitive at a publisher. But really, we thought, okay, well, one of the reasons for there being so many ads is because people are taking such big cuts when they deliver ads on page. And that, to me, having kind of worked at a publisher, sold software to publishers for a long time, was kind of like near and dear to me. And it's like, look, if we can give more revenue back to these amazing brands that have been around for 10, 20, 50, hundreds of years, depending on who you look at, it kind of guarantees the future, the continuity of what they're doing, journalism, the ad-funded internet, which is the best way for the internet to exist. I think subscriptions can work, but fundamentally still is quite annoying for a user. Like, I'd always find if you find an article and you're like, oh, I don't subscribe, it's like, are you going to subscribe for one article? Probably not. Maybe you would if it's a long form piece. Like I just did one on, I downloaded a subscription to The Economist because they had a whole piece on India and we've got an office out there, so I wanted to really understand as best I could India as a market. But I think I'm not the archetypical customer that'll just be like, I don't want to sign up for that. And they'll just go on and find some content elsewhere. So that for us is really important. It's delivering high CPMs to publishers so they can make more revenue and put some of that money back and reinvest that money into journalism and improving user experience without suffering on the revenue side of things.
I think you touched a lot of very interesting points and topics. Please remind me if I miss some. I think the issue with too many ads, I think, is also a result of the strategies of media owners that initially didn't understand anything about programmatic advertising.
Yeah.
So what they did, they hired a lot of ad tech execs and handed them over the keys of their monetization. The issue is that with time, it wasn't the commercial part, the monetization of media wasn't run by media execs.
Yeah,
it was
okay.
run
yeah.
by ad tech execs, mm-hmm. who saw the product as the ad slot, while the product is content.
Yeah, true.
And that is a huge reason why I think there is a decline and a disconnection with the relationship in the relationship with the audience. And then it's about another bad habit we have in the industry is applying blueprints. So subscription, yes, subscription, no.
Mm.
Dynamic paywall, yes. Dynamic paywall, no.
Yeah.
Podcast, 30 minutes, 1 hour.
Yeah.
And then everybody's applying that.
Yeah.
So I think that we need to go back into listening to the audience and having a two-way communication channel with the audience and understanding what the audience needs.
Yeah.
And expect. And plus, I don't think there is a future, or the future is limited for media owners that are not differentiated. They don't provide a unique content. Mm. Going back to the shared experience of News UK, when the Times went behind a paywall, mm-hmm. they understood that breaking news would be always available for free on the BBC, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They decided no 24/7 updates, three editions,
mm-hmm.
one in the morning, one midday, one in the afternoon, opinions, commentaries, investigations, analysis. And that was... it was what made them unique, but we can see it also with many other successful publishers. And plus, another, and I think this is the biggest obstacle to a thriving future for media owners, is to think that differentiation of revenue channels is just a plug-and-play exercise. It requires a complete rethinking and review of the strategy. It requires a whole company business transformation,
mm-hmm.
where the whole company is aligned behind an overarching goal.
Yeah.
But also the different teams and departments know where their objectives are, and making sure that they all roll up to the overarching goal. Without that, it will perpetuate the issues where you have the advertising team providing a certain user experience, the mm-hmm. subscription team providing a different message, the marketing team a different message, but even within the same teams, I've seen as a subscriber clashing actions coming from evidently the subscription acquisition team and subscription retention team. So we need to transform the business of media, and we need to rethink of the strategies, and that's I think is the what will make the difference.
Yeah, I think you touch on some quite interesting points. And I used to work for a business called ShareThrough, which was a native ad exchange. And what I was always quite surprised about was editorial teams didn't really care too much about display or video ads. It was when we said, okay, well, you can make a piece of branded content that looks a bit like content, but isn't, still is content, but it's paid for. They tended to have a real issue with that. And to me, that is almost how they should have approached all ad formats in general, because they all impact the content ultimately, whether they look like content or they look like a display ad or a video ad. And I think if you were to kind of continue that process logically, it's like in the same way that you have with print, for example. It's like you have a single page spread, a double page spread, you have a small ad unit, you know, but they were very uniform, and it was then really a lot more thought was put into, the amount of effort that went into an ad creative, and like a shoot for a model in GQ, let's say, was like, there's a ton of people involved in making sure that that's a really good looking ad. And that was almost additive to the content, you know, like some really glossy ads for luxury brands from LVMH, shall we say, in GQ, like added to the experience of the magazine for me when I used to buy GQ. And I think that should, or maybe it is being used, but like is a real opportunity to create a ad experience that is not just brand A, brand B, brand C, you know, like being a bit more curated with the types of brands, how those different ad formats are executed, and like, okay, we have this suite of ad formats, not just someone that's taking care of display or video or pre-roll. It's like, here's our ad units. You can use these to tell a story somehow, figure out the best way to tell a story, and then make that curation of ad units kind of fall into your strength of curation of content, which is very unique to a particular publisher. It's something that CNN do really well. So they do really great branded content that's been hugely popular for them. They also have a lot of connected TV ads, which are very much in vogue at the moment. But ultimately, in my opinion, it's just video. You know, there's not a whole lot of difference between a 30-second sound on video on TV as your pre-roll. It's just on a slightly bigger or smaller screen. But just like thinking about the way that you put your ads together holistically, which is tough programmatically, but still, I've always been, I'm going all over the shop here, but I've always been annoyed at the word programmatic because it's used as a noun. It's just a verb, right? It's the way that the ad's bought and sold, which is every ad is bought and sold, because there's not someone deciding to buy an ad, you know?
That has been one of the biggest, I mean, one of the things that drove me crazy in the past. What is your programmatic strategy? Well, there is no programmatic strategy. It was what your strategy is. Yeah. Programmatic is a channel.
Exactly.
And yes, one of the issues have been that constrained companies, media owners, to the lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. to satisfy the what I call the delusion of infinite reach at infinite quality. So it's a very important part, but also, isn't it funny? You're talking about this harmony between mm-hmm. content, the experience, the ads, the environment, and media owners are terrified by, or terrified, or in the industry, we are obsessed with brand reputation.
Yeah.
And brand suitability,
mm-hmm.
but it's only one way.
Yeah, true.
It's advertisers being worried of mm-hmm. where they end their ads end up, and media owners are not raising their voice, saying, or anyway, developing strategies and actions that will protect their brand from rubbish ads.
Yeah,
it's a two way. Issue. I think in many occasions ads are a brand reputation threat
totally
to media
agree.
Owners.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
I think particularly when you look at like content recommendation ad units, you know, like that. That's
don't get me started.
Yeah, that's an interesting business model, right? Where you're just like moving individuals around different websites from the content graveyard, if you want to call it that. But it's two very large companies that do a really good job of that, that make $1 billion in revenue every year. You know, it's like not too dissimilar to like the way in which people are moved around via search, you know, like it's like it kind of happens without you searching at the bottom of a page for a publisher and then moves people around, and it's quite lucrative, but it's weird.
It's totally opposite to what an aligned strategy should be.
Yeah.
Very often they sit alongside quality content.
Yeah.
And they ruin the effectiveness of that content.
Yeah.
They annoy the user. They affect the brand reputation. Mm-hmm. They affect the overall category reputation. Quality publishers are screaming and ranting about MFA and all the consequences that we are seeing in the industry, the fact that third parties can label any media owner as MFA, high MFA, low MFA, medium MFA, again, like keyword blocking, they are at the mercy of a third party media owners. Yet they are the ones that host the gates to this type of content on their pages. And this shows how much damage misalignment does to media owners.
And I just also think that, like, made for advertising is a funny way to describe content at large, because, like, is not most content made for advertising? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's very few publications, if any, which are created just for the love of the game. Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe not even Wikipedia. Wikipedia runs ads, you know? Like, there's no just, here's content for content's sake, and it's not made for any. I think that's, it's a weird, don't quite get it.
Because I think that many media owners lost that thought, that their DNA, the product is content. Yeah. Content attracts the audience.
Exactly.
And the audience, and your role in advertising as a media owner is to connect audiences to ads.
Yeah.
And yeah. we have missed that kind of relationship. So again, we need to go back and seeing content as a product and being audience-centric, but being audience-centric, not through assumptions, oh, this is what the audience wants. It's about asking the audience, what do you want?
Yeah.
And this, you do this through frequent surveys, user groups, having a constant communication channel open.
And this is where I think, not my teeth out there, Web3 comes into its own as far as, like, an audience versus a community, which kind of the same thing, but there's a bit more of a two-way street, you know? Like, we speak to people in the ads or alchemy community on a daily basis, you know? Like, we have moderators that sit in our respective channels and answer questions about alchemy. We have governance proposals on what people can do on the network. So it's much more of a two-way street, which makes way more sense to me than we're like, we think you want this, you know, like, where actually if you listen to people, people will say anything. I think if you go too far, you can end up where people that, I always use the Boaty McBoatface example of that ship that's like, what do you want to name it? And everyone voted to name it Boaty McBoatface, which is a shame for that ship, but really allows for better two-way conversations, which is how conversation should be, right?
Sure, absolutely. But I'm asking you, how long did it take to create that community? How much effort?
Significant.
Yes. And that's where a lot of media owners stop. They have been used to plug and play. Tag on the page, you'll increase your revenue by X%, and we still have that kind of approach in many situations. So to build solid, durable, engaging relationships, you need to plant seeds, you need to nurture them, you need to put effort and resources.
Yeah, and I think that is probably like an effect of a lack of revenue passing through to a publisher, because there's like nearly every article you read will have a comment section. Like, sometimes I read the comment section on the FT, which can be hit or miss, but sometimes you do get some really considered and insightful comments on an interesting article, and you very rarely see any engagement from either the journalist or someone that represented the FT to kind of coax that conversation along, encourage it, and then you're missing out on what could be a very interesting place for a brand to position itself if it wanted to become part of that conversation. That was, okay, if a brand is relevant contextually to a particular content, And then there's comments underneath it that are related to the content of that or the context of that article. Why would you not, as a brand, then want to be involved somewhat? I'm not quite sure how I'm thinking out loud here, but with the conversation that's going on around an article that you thought was contextually relevant to the brand that you're trying to advertise, it's like almost a missed opportunity for publishers. And again, I think it's because they're getting pulled in many directions. They are losing tens, 20, 30 cents on the dollar for every ad they're selling programmatically. So it's not so true for direct campaigns, but I think just by creating a, particularly for programmatic or open marketplace, I'm talking about a way in which publishers are rewarded more fairly for the value they're creating, because a direct campaign might be $10, $20 CPM. And it's purely a case of they haven't got enough resource to sell 100% of their inventory direct, that you're then maybe selling it at $1 or a $2 or $3 CPM for exactly the same bit of content, same audience, same context. You know, it's just a shame that a lot of that isn't then passed on, because there's so many fees taken out of the middle by people that, as you said, arbitrarily decide whether a user was fraudulent or this piece of content is made for advertising or whatever it may be. It's like they just, I feel for publishers because media owners, because they lose a lot of the agency over the value of their content through a lack of time and resource.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one of the issues. I don't think, and that is absolutely great. Mm. We need more transparency.
Yeah.
Or better, we need transparency, and we need clearer relationships. Mm-hmm. But it's not enough. Mm. It's not. I'm talking about the bigger picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely necessary, but it's not enough. Mm. It starts with the strategy. We need as a category, as an industry, but we all need the agency, the advertiser, the ad tech. We need media owners with stronger strategies, and this absolutely would help. But we need not to fool ourselves thinking that without a strategy will just because they will earn more on advertising then things will be solid and media owners will be self-sustainable. An example, not everybody, but many in ad tech see and present interoperability as the holy grail.
Mm.
And I'm saying we had the third-party cookie interoperability for almost 20 years more. We didn't have GDPR.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a privacy sandbox. We didn't have Apple's ATT, and we didn't have many of what today are perceived obstacles. Mm. But look what happened.
Yeah.
And I actually think that GDPR, if we are not now today talking about transparency and we are talking about fairness and we are talking about what you are providing an industry with, is also because there was a moment where, and I think it started with GDPR saying enough, if it is enough.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's I remember at Share3, I was like, one day GDPR didn't exist, and the next day we were like, shit, it's so hard to now monetize inventory without a consent framework. And even the consent frameworks had questions about its validity and whether it is actually managing consent or not. It's also quite a clunky user experience. And I think it's doing something important. It's protecting the privacy of individuals, which should be done. But it was kind of retrofitted to what was already quite an old system of targeting ads. And I think it's not what cookies were intended for. It's device IDs kind of fortuitously became a unique identifier by which you could target ads, but that's not what they're intended for. And I think, it's where we get quite excited at Alchemy about the adoption of wallets, so like the way you hold and store crypto, blockchain tokens, NFTs, you name it, because where there's a lot of talk at the moment with cookies disappearing about unified ID solutions or whatever it may be. And I think that, or those solutions are very much a, we as a business need to find a solution for third-party cookies and then retrofit it into how users do things and audiences do things. And I think the blockchain wallet is very different. It's not too dissimilar to when mobile phones came around. You know, like I used a mobile phone because it was easier to instant message my friends if I had something that was in my pocket all the time versus having to go back to my computer and send it via MSN. And I think some people listen to me and be like, what the hell is MSN? But that was when desktop computers were big, right? But it became useful to advertisers because a piece of hardware was adopted that coincidentally had this really great identifier for advertisers. And same with third-party cookies, right? They were there because the internet needed a way to remember which page you just came from. Or if you were looking at a pair of shoes halfway down a page on an e-commerce site, you didn't go straight back to the top, which would be annoying. You kind of went back to where you were and it kept you logged into a platform. You know, that was what it was there for. And then it was used for a whole load of other things that built the industry that we know and love. But these new ID solutions aren't a reason for people to change their behavior, which coincidentally comes along with the great identifier. And I think that is where crypto wallet has the solution. It's like, hey, you use it to enter the blockchain world, and it just so happens each wallet has its own unique identifier, which is written on chain, and you know what it is, and you know some information about what's in that wallet. That becomes quite useful to target ads in the future, I think.
I think that whatever solution, it would not fulfill its potential without involving the audience and communicating the message to the audience. And it's even if you think at the beginning, I mean, we have seen consent as a tick boxing. That was a good one. Exercise. So it's an opportunity for a quality media owner to differentiate themselves.
Totally agree.
From dodgy competition.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's being again a rush to the bottom. Sign here.
Yeah.
And that needs to be incorporated. Whatever technology. Even for blockchain, it has to involve the user.
Yeah, and that's where we're seeing a lot of or having some really great conversations with like crypto media, if you want to call it that, like publications that are writing about blockchain, which is, in my opinion, very interesting. It's varying degrees of interesting for certain types of people, but they are uniquely positioned to capitalize on an audience that probably has a wallet already and use that as a solution for a cookie, because they don't have to go through, they do educate people on blockchain content and blockchains, but if you're visiting a blockchain website, I think it's a fair assumption that you have some degree of knowledge about a particular blockchain anyway. You may even have a wallet. So there's a real chance for this new kind of category of publication to take advantage of what is quite inefficient infrastructure that powers monetization at the moment. But what I found quite interesting is that a lot of crypto publishers aren't that au fait with what are quite advanced strategies and clever ways to monetize web inventory, because they're so focused on the future. They kind of not forget, but just underestimate perhaps the amount of revenue that's available if you do really nail a programmatic ad strategy and a direct ad strategy, you know, because they have a very valuable audience, and it takes a long time to figure out exactly what to do with that.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, you see some that are too into the future. Many are too still into the past.
Yeah, it's funny because like we have two types of conversations with publishers. One is like explaining a blockchain, and one is explaining ad tech. And there, it's often that, well, the Web2 publisher, if you want to call it that, needs to be explained blockchain, but the Web3, it's like, it's weird. It doesn't really make, like, you'd think as you came up, you'd probably figure out monetization, but then probably wouldn't. If you just started writing a website because you wanted to provide a need for an audience, you don't necessarily go, I'm going to do this to make a load of money. You're just doing it because I love to write content about Bitcoin or Ethereum or whatever blockchain it is you're interested in.
But ultimately is the interface with with the audience. I think the responsibility of the technology lies in whoever is implementing it.
Yeah.
But the success of it lies on trust.
Yeah.
And the communication of the value exchange that I think only too few publishers, media owners in general do. It's very limited. And it's an enormous missed opportunity.
And do you think that that's because there's not enough of an incentive for the individual or the publisher to spend the time communicating the value exchange?
There is no alignment.
Yeah.
And that's back to what I was mentioning earlier. What is your overarching goal that needs to be tied to a business outcome? Is, okay, in 3 years' time, I will have this revenue, will have this number of unique users, this number of registered users. So you know that to achieve that, you need as well to have a consent strategy.
Yeah.
A strategy to communicate the value exchange. And by the way, we have seen last week News UK again.
There are other publications available.
Yes. No, but I mean, and I'm using as an example, they sent out an ad for a head of consent.
Really?
So that's a very encouraging sign, because it's not about tackling the challenges in isolation. It's about seeing the bigger picture. In fact, that role will connect to all the different touch points and use cases within the company.
Yeah. So what other, if you were to look 1, 2, 3 years into the future, what do you think that the industry needs to do better, or will do better, or can do better, or a publisher or a media agency, kind of however you want to take that, like, where do you see it going?
So I would first of all stop looking at technology, start working on a strategy, then go back to technology and see what technology is supporting your strategy.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we will keep doing the same mistakes over and over again. So we need to differentiate what is an objective, what is a strategy, and what is an instrument. I'm excited by AI.
Yeah.
But also very worried if it's used in the wrong way.
Totally, yeah.
Again, it has to be an instrument. Again, the future for media owners is, and when I say media owners, it means quality media environments. Are quality media, are quality environments which quality audiences visit. And that is a projected benefit to a quality advertising environment. So I'm talking about media owners, but that affects the whole ecosystem. And so still need to be unique and differentiated. AI will become, is already, but will become even more a commodity. They will need to use AI to, and that's exciting, because smaller media owners with less resources will be able to free their employees for higher quality tasks.
True.
And hopefully more differentiated, unique content. And I'm excited about, although many cynical colleagues call it a negotiated surrender. I'm very excited about the deals between OpenAI and the FT, Axel Springer, Le Monde, Prisa. It's first of all creates a precedent. So it's recognized that using publishers' quality content to train the model, it has got a value and needs to pay for. It shows that companies are responsibly looking at quality content to train their models.
Yeah.
It will disseminate and propagate content while it's paid for, because they will mention the source.
Yeah.
Unlike social media, for example, and that will be a good incentive for media companies to invest in quality content, to think of their editorial mm-hmm. propositions, to hire more journalists. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, because I think it's one of the kind of interesting applications specifically for a media owner for AI, or at least in my opinion, is a lot of large media owners are oftenly like geographically very specific. Do you know what I mean? Like you have like Bild is big in Germany and the Times is big in the UK and Prisa is big in Spain. Is that right? And what you could do really like, and they each have like their specific, have an interesting take on a particular event that become increasingly global, you know, and just like, the ability for one journalist to write a great piece of content in Spanish and then have AI translate that into various different languages while still maintaining the tone because it's been trained on that specific content rather than like an arbitrary translation, kind of allows content to become a bit more borderless, at least from like these storied, old, very valuable media publications. So there is more content is more available to more people because one person can produce 20 to 30 iterations in various different languages.
Absolutely. But think also how to continuously reuse old content.
Yeah, true.
So if you have your own dedicated chatbot, I don't know, the FT, where I can interact with the chatbot and the chatbot will collate and communicate with me based on the FT archive and what the FT opinions and values are. It's something that will bring back also value that otherwise very often is there sleeping.
Yeah,
talking about necessarily content that you can on a chatbot that you can serve ads on.
Yeah.
Although I don't know what if the chatbot could contain ads. I don't know. It depends on. But that's not the point. The point is that it translates the legacy, the inheritance, the historical content of a publication.
Yes, it's quite a cliche, but it's like there's history often, it doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, and journalistic publications are just a good account of stuff that went on over the period of kind of the existence of that particular publication. So it's like a research tool to more easily kind of get a temperature check of that particular period of time has got to be valuable and useful for someone doing something that's happening now, kind of look to the past, okay, what had happened then around this particular time period, like how were people writing articles around certain periods of time, and what how can we use those insights in a way that perhaps we'd forget or don't use because it's not that easy to access that content, or at least index it and find it in a way that I guess you can do with search engines to some degree, but like after it doesn't learn necessarily exactly how you're looking to find that content.
And to me it's exciting to notice that for the very first time in many years, media owners are taking the bull by the horns and leading rather than following.
Yeah, I agree.
Because in monetization they've been following for a long time. And to today that the this type of deals I think will change their role in the future.
Yeah, I guess they've had chance to like catch up, as it were. Do you know what I mean? Like not to say that they're slow by any standards, but like they have a lot of things to do and they have something else quite slow, but they've now kind of, I guess, like learned from their mistakes, as it were, or things perhaps they didn't do that well. And as you say, taking the bull by the horns with new technology that's coming in so that doesn't happen again. So yeah, excited about AI. Is there anything else? I always talk about like the next bit of hardware that will change content, because like I always talk to Geddy, one of our developers, about the keyboard. Like the keyboard's been around since a typewriter, and it's still like the best way to like interface largely with a screen. Like AR and VR hasn't quite cracked it yet. Maybe it'll be that, but like I'd be interested to hear your take on like whether you think there's some kind of new hardware that will change it.
Again, it's speculation. I'm fascinated by the Vision Pro.
Yeah, okay.
At least I read the reviews and I'm thinking, okay, what opportunities for immersive content that will offer. But then again, we had a lot of new technology and new bursts of trends, then disappeared. But I like to look at technology and think, okay, how that could make content unique.
Yeah, and I think that Apple has the. Like people have Apple devices as a status symbol, you know. It's like people probably won't walk around the streets with a Quest, Vision Quest on, you know. But
I wouldn't walk with a Vision Pro either.
me neither. But some people will. I think I've seen it on Twitter and what have you, that it becomes a bit of a status symbol. And I think when the first iPod came out, it was pretty clunky with the four buttons it had, and then they nailed the click wheel, and then that was just like boom, it's absolutely everywhere. And I think maybe there's something around the form or the function of a Vision Pro. It does feel like very iPod One. Obviously it's Vision Pro One, but like that got very good very quickly. And I think we'll probably see the same thing happen with a Vision Pro, and it's got the brand equity for people to be out in public doing it. And I think that is the killer, is that like augmented reality certainly is better when you actually leave your house. I think virtual reality, still part of me is like, you can die in a virtual reality game, let's say, and it's fine because stuff can really go wrong when you're in the real world, you know. And that is still the big point I can't get past, is that like you could never truly lose yourself to virtual reality, because there is still that like risk that we all have as human beings. It's like we want to stay alive, you know, and it's like that is riskier when you're in a virtual reality versus augmented reality, which is slightly different. I think that will be the key, is because even like Google Glass back in the day, that just wasn't cool enough for people to do it, but the Vision Pro perhaps has got that cool factor that maybe will usher it in as the next interesting bit of hardware. But yeah, I think about that a lot, like what is the next killer bit of hardware.
Again, I might sound old-fashioned. Mm. It's absolutely a need.
Yeah,
to look into the future. Mm. But if we go back to media owners, they need to fix their foundation first.
True. Yeah, very true.
And no matter what technology, it's audience centricity that is crucial, and the user experience. Mm. Then everything else is an instrument.
So it's still very much, yeah, you look after your audience and then it kind of looks after you, as it were.
Yes. And it's a constant open dialogue.
Mm. Yeah. Cause I think then, yeah, that's one of the reasons. So I'm drinking the Kool-Aid because I work at Alchemy, but I think that's where we do have quite an important part to play in delivering publishers more revenue, so that they can, and not just like more ads equals more revenue. It's like, no, we'll pay you more money for the ads that currently exist. And actually we'd encourage you to remove certain ad units, because if we can pay you $3, $4, $5 CPM for an ad unit you were getting $1 to $2, you could feasibly have 2 to 5 times less ads on your page, which is going to help the conversation you then have with your audience in terms of the user experience, but then equal you getting more revenue, so you have more time to focus on your audience, so it really matters. And hope we can deliver that value for the publishers that we work with.
Absolutely, that's needed. It's also important that you work together with them. I strongly believe that there is the opportunity to think of new formats, more engaging formats. It's still the it's almost a replica of what we had on paper. You had the little square on a digital device, and there are other ways for media owners to connect their audiences to the advertiser.
Yeah, we've actually developed a format that we call 100% share of screen. So this is something that publishers have sold for a long time, kind of the page takeover, as it were, but where we take our fees are 3 to 8% compared to industry standards, which can be, I don't know, 30 to 90% fees, right? What that means is that we submit very, very competitive bids, high bids, into a auction that takes place on page in your pre-bid wrapper. So that gives us the ability to, when we want to, if an advertiser wants to, we can, maybe there's 3 ad units on a page, we can bid and win on all of those ad units to give you the opportunity to kind of programmatically purchase a header, an MPU, and then maybe something that's in the content somewhere to tell like a sequential message through existing ad formats. We're just able to win it because we're paying publishers so much more for them. And our win rates are like 40 to 70% versus like 5 to 10%, which you'd see traditionally.
And then storytelling, creativity in advertising is very much needed back.
Yeah, totally.
And as I said earlier, programmatic has created this minimum common denominator that needs to be fulfilled. And having back creativity and storytelling it's a great addition to user engagement,
because it's what makes each media owner unique, right? Is their perspective and their creative slant on that specific story. They why not apply that value? And again, to come back to CNN, they do that really well. They use their perspective to tell really good stories in their kind of theme or tone of voice, whatever it is, that more media owners should kind of look to replicate that model, because I know it's worked really effectively for them.
And keeping in mind that assets of media owners need not to be decoupled. So the value of the ad is also the environment it totally is served on.
Yeah.
So it's not just the type of content, is the engagement of the audience, is the reputation of the brand, it's the creativity in the ad. So it's all the union.
The editorial halo, I think, is something that you could probably use to describe.
But
that.
We have been used for too long to deal with assets like they were a bag of popcorns.
Yeah, totally.
And we need to remember that that's the sum of the assets is much bigger than the individual ones.
Yeah, totally agree. So yeah, have you got any other, I guess we've spoken about quite a lot there, I think. So if you wanted to, I guess, like wrap that up into like a closing thought of your take on things that need to change in the future to deliver more value for, I guess, advertisers, media owners, and then us as internet users.
Sure. I mean, it's evident to me that in the industry there are conflicting interests, which cause for 20 years and still today the ecosystem to be imbalanced.
Yeah. Yeah.
And an imbalanced ecosystem does not survive.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to bring that balance back. And that also with the understanding that quality digital advertising environment can exist if a quality media environment exists. And that costs money.
True.
So media monetization, the old way, cannot fund this type of quality, which requires a diversified revenue channels, and which requires strategy, which require alignment, alignment of objectives, but also of incentives.
Yeah, okay.
Bottom line, strategy.
Okay. Well, with that, I think thank you very much, Alessandro. It was absolutely a pleasure chatting to you. I think it was really interesting. So it's good to speak a lot about media owners, because sometimes we spend a lot of time talking about advertisers and the blockchain. So it was great to hear your perspectives. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you very much.